This is the Fantasy Focus Books and Authors Podcast, episode 17. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Fantasy Focus Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is, folks, a show based and focused on everything in fantasy books. From epic fantasy to urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, and everything in between, I want you to expect to find the best and brightest authors and books from all the various corners of the fantasy book world here on the show. Plus, we'll add in some other special guests along the way, so stay tuned. I'm super excited this week as I ramp up for the launch of my latest book, Cyber's Change. I'm really excited about it. If you like a book with a touch of cyberpunk sci-fi and a set in a dystopian world, you might want to take advantage of the 99-cent pre-order available that will be there until we launch. So it'll be there till the day of launch, and then it'll be changing to its normal price. So if you want to pick that up at the pre-order price of 99 cents, you want to look that up. Cyber's Change by Jamie Davis is what you look for. I'll have a link in the show notes. I'm also digging back into that new urban fantasy gaming project that I mentioned a few weeks ago in the podcast. I don't know about you all, but I've been getting a case of spring fever, and I'm looking forward to getting into that project as well as enjoying some of the better weather here in the Mid-Atlantic area. Gives me an opportunity to do some of my writing outside where I can enjoy my yard and the view of the woods I have. Maybe in the near future, I'll share a picture of that from where I sit on the deck and look out over the expansive, expansive for me, backyard. As always, if you're interested in more information on what I'm up to, check out my fan group over on Facebook, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Superfans, or my website and blog, jamiedavisbooks.com. And I always look forward to hearing from you. So if you want to reach out and leave a message for me or use the contact form over on the website, or reach out to me on social media, whatever the case may be, I look forward to hearing from all of you. I don't know about you, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's episode interview. I interviewed author Richard Nell. Richard is a Canadian author of fantasy living in one of the flattest, coldest places on earth with his begrudging wife who makes sure he eats and eats well. He's been a dishwasher, a bricklayer, a bin sweeper, a floor waxer, a factory worker, government employee, and has even managed a few teams in what he refers to as the bloody insurance business. So what else do you need to know about him? Well, he says he has one eye, a few useless English degrees, enjoys history and video games and learning of all kinds, and he really loves especially ideas. So I had a great time chatting with Richard on this one, so check out my interview. It's coming up right now. Richard, welcome to the Fantasy Focus Podcast. I want to thank you again for making some time to come on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, sir.
So why don't you take a few minutes and let us know a little bit about yourself? I know there's probably a good number of our listeners that know who you are, but so for those that don't, let us fill us in.
I usually assume that I'm in utter obscurity, but so I'm a full-time fantasy writer. I guess that's obvious if I'm on this podcast. And I'm a Canadian. I live in the prairies. I'm sort of half farm kid, half city kid. And I'm one of those always knew I'd be a writer types. But I also knew I was young and stupid and that I needed more experience. So I guess I went out and got some of it. I worked a lot of jobs. I went to school. And then as I was getting older, I just thought, you know, it's now or never. And I quit my job. I had a very grown up professional career. Without any real indication that would be a good idea. And I just sat down at my desk and I started writing full time, which I did for 2 years, a bit over 2 years, before I put out my debut book, Kings of Paradise. And now the sequel to that has just come out, Kings of Ash, with the third book hopefully out next year. So that's my sort of main claim to fame, I guess we'll say. And I've also been writing other things in the same genre, Flintlock Fantasy. I've got a couple of novellas out, and those are the start of what will be another trilogy called The God King Chronicles. And really, I've got about five more projects, so I just need time to write it all down and get it out.
That is the big trick, isn't it, for us writers, is to find the time to write and write the things that are we're drawn to write, which we'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later, because I want to talk definitely about the Flintlock novellas that you have, because they're intriguing to me based upon some things I've written. But let's start off with Kings of Paradise, because that's your first thing you put out. Where did the story kind of come to you? Is it something that had been rattling around in your head for a while, or was this something you kind of arrived at after kind of digging in for 2 years and kind of putting it all together?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. The 2 years that I was writing, it was sort of mostly just honing the craft a little bit, finding my voice. And I'd always written. I went to school for writing and English, and I've been writing since I was young, but it's sort of different when it becomes a real profession. You know, when you sit down and treat it like a craft, you spend several hours a day. So that was what I was doing. I wasn't necessarily crafting the story for King's Paradise, but the story started as really just two different, vastly different cultures that came together. That was really the initial idea. But then once I created the characters, it really started to change and take on a life of its own. So it's a big book. It's a big, dark, fantasy, epic, sort of George Martin style, gray characters. I think it's 600 pages. Some people have called it grimdark. I didn't know what grimdark was when I started writing the book, so that was news to me. But one of the characters definitely lives in a darker climate. It's this cold, frozen wasteland. Life is very difficult. And so the opening scene for this character is he's actually in the wild, and he has killed a boy and is eating him to survive, more or less. So it's fairly dark. Whereas the other main character, very much a contrast, is the son of a king. He lives in these beautiful island paradise and really has no difficulties. In the story, he faces a variety of hardships, but at least when it starts, compared to the other character, his life is very good. And so he's been thrown into the Marines to kind of toughen him up. So the first book is really a coming-of-age story of these two main characters. And the trilogy is sort of the coming together of these cultures and the discovery of new magic and how these particular characters will help change the world. So it's definitely epic fantasy, big stakes.
Wow, and it seems quite expansive. I know that the initial character you described is described as born malformed and ugly in the snow-covered wasteland. That just brings so much world building to mind just with that one sentence, and it certainly conjures a dark place, but also makes me wonder what's going on. So I think it's done a good job. It's achieved its goal of getting me intrigued.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. The characters are definitely, it's a character-driven story for sure. And sort of jokingly amongst my few fans, let's say that you're either on Team Kale or you're on Team Ruka, Ruka being the deformed outcast and Kale being the prince. So there's definitely a collision course in the making, let's say, and you've got to pick your team at some point.
Wow. Now I'm definitely, and it's funny, my to read list since I've started this podcast has grown enormously.
I bet.
But it's wonderful to speak to the authors and like yourself and get a sense of kind of behind the scenes and what drew you to do certain things in certain ways. You said you didn't know what grimdark was. I really wasn't too aware of grimdark. I'll say darker fantasy, although sometimes darker tones tend to creep into my books from time to time. But I didn't know what grimdark was either. And it certainly started to catch my eye when I started reading some of the books that filled into that category. Does it bother you that you're labeled grimdark, or does it seem like it fits now that you have heard about it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not even sure I know exactly what grimdark is. I know I've seen some polls from Mark Lawrence where he's trying to get people to describe it, and you get 50 different definitions. So it's hard to know exactly what people mean. It's dark in terms of some of the content. For me, I guess I'm a real history buff, and so I just try and make my stories as realistic to the technology level, let's say, as I possibly can. So this is sort of an Iron Age story. It's you might call it medieval, but it sort of has a Southeast Asian flair, so it's not like European medieval history, let's say. And life was just very difficult in those times. It's very different than what we experience today. And so that's been true in terms of people's lives just day to day. It's true in terms of morality and everything else. So I don't see it as dark exactly. I just see it as realistic. But having said that, modern readers, they have different expectations and different understanding, let's say, of the history of mankind. So you're sort of playing with that. And if by grimdark you mean that it's hopeless, I definitely don't write hopeless stories. I'm a big fan of hope. So even if it's I think the reason to make a dark story really is because it's sort of always darkest before the dawn, right? You have to have a dark story to really hit the highs. You need the lows, if that makes sense.
It does. And for me, I think that when I hear grimdark, I actually think more of the grim. It is, history and life can be grim from time to time. And you're right. As I look back at my life, I realize it's those grim times, it's those hard times that have defined me. It's not the successes and the victories for certain. And I think that that's what makes characters in these situations shine. It's also that the characters aren't black and white. They're more shades of gray. And I think that that helps often rather than having the shining white hat hero and the shining and the dark black hat villain. You have people that fall all along that spectrum that appear in the story, and sometimes they're the hero and sometimes they're not.
Right. Well, and it's one guy can be hero and villain in different moments. I think that's what's so fascinating to me about humanity and writers like George Martin, where you have got a character that can do something quite horrific, but then maybe years later or maybe even days later do something that we would think of as heroic. And so is he a hero? Is he a monster? I love to play in that space.
Yeah, and something else you said was that the expectations of the modern reader, and I think that that's something that I haven't really thought about, but because of my medical background, I actually have talked to people about the expectations for survivability from illnesses and things today are so different than they were even 50 years ago, and we take a lot of times modern medicine for granted. If you go back 100 years, say maybe two generations, people grew up and started families as adults expecting that they would lose a child to some childhood illness. And if they were lucky enough not to, certainly the people on either side of them in the neighborhood did. It was just something that happened. And, that's why if you go into old graveyards, you see all of these, baby headstone and graves, because that dates back to the time when children died of, something like diabetes, which we can treat nowadays. I think that you're right. That expectation is why the darkness of some of these stories, even though they're historically accurate for the time period they're set in, can be really dark or seem dark to people when at the time it was just life.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's sort of just, it goes on and on. The child mortality is one thing, but just the sheer difficulty of life without all of our modern tools. It's just modern people have a lot of people at least have difficulty understanding that. And so in the story, as one example, in this land of ash, it's called the sort of more difficult environment with Ruka, the people there have evolved, let's say, to, for the most part, have twins and triplets because they lose so many children young. So it's just sort of one of the examples of the sort of details of how difficult this culture is. And they don't have a lot of respect for life just because they've sort of have to do that just to cope with their losses.
Yeah. That's just a fact of life. I mean, there are cultures even today that don't name their children until they reach the age of two.
I picked that detail out. Yes.
Yeah. That's something that, you know, is real and it's shocking to people in, you know, a modern industrial culture, because how could you not name your child?
Yeah. It just seems horrible and wrong, but it's sort of a self-defense mechanism. You know, if you don't name it, then if you lose it, then it's not quite so horrifying. But just discussing this, right? I mean, it seems very dark. It seems very grim. And I know, you know, and a good example of a character that dies, what's his name? The Khal Drogo in Game of Thrones. He dies from an infection, right? And people are just sort of horrified by this death. It seems so anticlimactic. But that's how a huge number of sort of military commanders and generals died, was something like sepsis or an infection, or because it's just they didn't know how to deal with it.
Absolutely. And I tell people all the time, you know, people used to die when they pricked their finger on a thorn in their garden,
or at least lose a hand,
you know, or at least lose their hand because of it. Yeah, it's amazing to think about. This is fascinating. This is actually, you know, I've talked to a lot of grimdark authors, but we haven't gone in this direction. And it's kind of an interesting twist on taking a look at this through the eyes of the modern reader. So that's fascinating. Thank you for opening that up for us.
My pleasure.
Your characters here, you said you kind of based them on being opposites to each other. When you put characters together for your stories, do you start with the character, or do you start with an overarching story idea and then build the characters into it?
Oof, that's a tough one. Well, I tend to start with world building. So I build the world first. I try and get an understanding of the cultures and all the rules and everything else. And then I'll start thinking about story. So, but you can't really, story can only go so far without the characters. So they're sort of, I couldn't tell you which one comes first and how they start, but for Kings of Paradise in particular, I was really taken with the characters. But I think Ruka in particular, he sort of haunted my dreams after a while. You know, I'd be working out and I could hear his voice. He just sort of never went away. And his story is sort of not finished. And I just sort of a manic, sort of terrifying impulse to just keep this story going. So, yeah, by the end, I was definitely absorbed by the characters and the story is a little bit surprising to me. I did know the ending of the series more or less when I started, but how I got there, I really didn't know. So it was sort of a circuitous path and the characters are driving the way.
So when you talked about your various jobs and career paths and things on the way to where you reached the point where you said, I'm going to stop and be a writer. How often do you find that varied path you took finding its way into your stories? You know, because you have such a rich collection of different jobs and different experiences to draw upon.
Well, it's hard to say, but I was sort of laughing. I know the writer Josiah Bancroft, who's sort of a self-published. I say I know him. I don't know him. I mean, I know of him. He wrote a story, I think, early in his life to BBC. And they sent him a letter back that said, we here at the BBC think you should live more and write less. And I think about that now, and I guess I sort of knew that myself. It's hard to write any kind of story realistically unless you have a bit of experience. I know, of course, you use your imagination as a writer, and that's the job description, but you need this strong sort of tapestry to work with, of knowledge of people and just experiences, whether that's work experience or, you know, tragedies in your own life or triumphs in your own life. You need to see the range of human emotions. And the young writers in particular are always very impressive to me if they do well, because I just think, how the hell do you do that without experience? But so I just find that's a requirement, sort of a baseline. If you don't have that, it's sort of hard to take you very seriously as a writer, or at least your palette, your color palette's a bit limited, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. And I think I've thought often that if I hadn't started writing, you know, at the age of 48, I'm not sure I would have come up with the rich stories that I like to think I write. You know, the reaction to my stories has been largely positive, which is great. But I don't think that would have been the case if I had started writing even 20 years ago in my late 20s, early 30s, because I, you know, so much has happened across the course of my life in that span of time.
And of course, you can learn the craft and you can hone the craft when you're young. There's no question about that. It's just, yeah, I struggle to see how you can insert just the life experience. There's only so much you can imagine, which is why it's always harder to write characters the more different from you they are, just because you're having to use your imagination more as opposed to being able to draw on something relatively from your own life or just something you've heard about or whatever.
You know, the few younger writers that I do know and have become acquainted with, it seems to me that the thing that they have going for them is really they are good observers of human nature. Because when I've talked to them, that's something that they do. When I've asked them what their tricks are for dialogue or different things, they'll say, "Oh, well, I just go and I sit in a coffee shop and I listen to everybody talking around me and I try to get an understanding of how they talk."
Yeah, well, it makes sense. And there's just some brilliant writers that they can pull it off when they're 25, maybe. I just wasn't one of those. I needed more time.
Me too. Absolutely. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about Rebellion of the Black Militia, because this takes place not in an Iron Age or world of medieval bent, shall we say, but more it comes forward in time when the advent of gunpowder has happened. And we talked a little bit briefly before we actually started recording about how that shifted the focus of politics and government and industry in such broad ways in actual history that it's a really an interesting time to explore in a fantasy world.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I couldn't tell you exactly why I wanted to write Flintlock, but I think it's that exploration of the change. It's not just technology. One thing that's always bugged me about fantasy is that the technology doesn't seem to change, particularly if you've got a society where they've got magic and the magic seems to be developing over time, and yet they're still using swords and spears and, you know, for thousands of years or something that hasn't changed. So I like the Flintlock fantasy, and this Rebellion of the Black Militia, it's actually a prequel novella that follows one character in particular, a scribe named Johann. And in this world, it's sort of there's gunpowder, but it's just the beginning of gunpowder, and so they still do use swords and spears and cavalry and all the rest of it. And there's also these demons in this world that people have managed to trap, and they use them, they bind them to a person. And so when they do that, the person gains almost kind of superpowers, but he's got this dark creature, sort of a passenger in his mind. It's very difficult. There's always drawbacks. And so the character in this story, he's being sent out more or less to capture one of these loose demons, and he's accompanying a knight to do this. It's sort of a story of a young academic who leaves the tower and has to learn about life a little bit as he does it. But there's a rebellion going on, and it's this powder duke, and there's these men with guns, and there's men with swords and spears, and there's this difficult fight. So I just love the genre. I love that era of history where there's so much change when you've got the monarchy versus these burgeoning republics. You've got these new gunpowder weapons, and the technology is changing so quickly that even maybe 10, 50 years later, you've got huge changes in how these weapons work. The longbow still exists and is a far better weapon, but it's not as effective as a bunch of peasants armed with guns. So it's just all very interesting to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've, in two different series that I've written, I've had in those worlds, I've had actually the advent of technology has just started to destroy and erode away at the power of magic. Because I've thought that the two cannot exist, that magic has taken the place of technology in some ways, but because not everyone can use it, the development of technology continues. And as that happens, it somehow draws away the effectiveness of magic as technology becomes more accepted.
Yeah, well, there's something a bit anticlimactic, I guess. This is the difficulty of your amazing hero and his unstoppable sword when he gets blasted by five guys with muskets. So you've got to sort of figure out how you're going to work that system, because nobody wants to read the story of your hero getting blasted down in 5 seconds. So, you have to come up with a magic system to deal with that or whatever. And there's lots of ways. I know a lot of writers have come up with very creative ways to deal with that, like powder mages and so on.
Well, and it comes back to that famous scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where where Indy, the guy comes out brandishing the giant scimitar and Indy just shoots him.
There's something just sort of, I don't know, it just destroys the human spirit a little bit. If you know this guy is trained for 25 years or something and he just gets shot.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think it's great. And that's one of the things that I explore is, they've got cannons and ships with, for close in action, when you board ship to ship in these stories, you still end up fighting hand to hand with swords and cutlasses. And
right. You know. Well, and these guns were terrible. They took at least 30 seconds, and that's probably, an expert flintlock rifle user to reload. And they jammed constantly. They blew up. I mean, there's all kinds of problems with these things. And so, as I say, the longbow was really far superior for a very long time. It's just that it took a lifetime to train an archer, whereas you could take any idiot off the street and train him in about 2 days to use a gun.
Yeah, put the fire here and close your eyes.
Basically.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I tell you, the Rebellion of the Black Militia is a book I'm looking forward to digging into. And I guess is a follow-up, The Devil of the 22nd?
It's not directly related. It's another story set in the same universe, let's say. It's another prequel to an eventual trilogy called The God King Chronicles. And so it follows another character in another area of the world. And this character is sort of I write gray characters, but this is one of the closest to on the darker side, I think, that I've ever written. He's sort of he's not a mercenary, but he's part of an army that has lost its patronage, let's say. Their emperor has the empire is falling apart as this republic forms. And there's this army on the outskirts of the empire that's sort of just been abandoned. And so this character, who's been in the army for his entire life, 25 years, he's sort of leading all of his colleagues into, well, what the hell are we going to do now? And they kind of just go rogue and they're going around for plunder and glory. So that sort of sets the scene of the story.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. As we wind up here, just want to kind of reach out and ask you to tell us a little bit about how you prefer to interact with readers. If anyone's listening to the show and wants to kind of contact you and reach out to you, I know you're active on some parts of social media out there. Is there a preferred medium that you like best?
I always like dealing with people one-on-one, even though that takes a lot of time. But yeah, feel free to email me or, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Goodreads, Reddit. But yeah, I've got a contact on my website at www.richardnell.com. And yeah, feel free to email me. I'm happy to talk to people.
Well, we'll definitely make sure there are links to all those things in the show notes so people can reach out to you on their preferred platform. And
awesome.
That'll be great. Richard, thanks for coming on the show. I hope as you have other projects that come to light that you will reach out to us and come back on sometime.
I will do that. Well, Kings of Ash, which is the sequel to King's Paradise, is out actually already. It came out in January. And then Kings of Heaven will be next year, and that'll be the end of the trilogy. So I will let you know when that happens. Maybe we do this again.
That would be fantastic.
Excellent. Thanks, Jamie.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Fantasy Focused Books and Authors podcast. Make sure you catch up with us online for a whole lot more from the whole Fantasy Focused community. You can find us in our Facebook group and over at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode and let me know what's on your mind. I'd love to hear from you. Also, over on the website, on each podcast episode post, you'll actually find links right there below the podcast player where you can subscribe to the show on your favorite mobile device using iOS or Android or apps like Stitcher and TuneIn. You can even subscribe by email. So click those links and subscribe to the show so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. We've got a lot of great people coming up for you. You won't want to miss. We have some pretty awesome authors scheduled coming up right away, including Andy Peliquin in the next episode, so you'll want to check that one out. And we'll go ahead and get ready to wrap up this show. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at Jamie Davis Books and at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can get a free book over there if you sign up for my newsletter and check in with me there. Whatever you do, though, subscribe and come back here for the next podcast. In the meantime, I'll remind you to keep your eyes open, folks, because you might miss it. There's magic all around you.